A lone pedestrian heads home through Milan's Piazza del Duomo. There are no other people. The once bustling metropolis looks like it's lost a part of its soul. In Hollywood, an empty tour bus is stationed in front of the Walk of Fame's Terrazzo and Brass Stars. A tour operator waits in vain. Once packed with commuter and tourists, the Blue Hills of Puerto San Bento's railway station now echo every footstep. Scenes of deserted cities fill the pages of our newspapers and clog our social media. The COVID-19 pandemic has dramatically changed the way we move. Cars have disappeared from city centers. Trains run on reduced schedules. We are asked to stay inside for as much as we can and to avoid non-essential travel. But moving indoors hasn't broken apart our globalized world. We're still connected. We've just shifted gears to cope with our new environment. What we don't know yet is how far this new road will lead us. Will the way we travel and commute change forever? How are our governments preparing for the future? Welcome to another episode of the Future Car Podcast. I'm Ed Bernardin, Vice President of Strategic Automotive Initiatives at Siemens PLM. Since the pandemic, the message from our governments has been to stay safe. That's why today's episode is all about safety, regulations, and what that means for automated vehicles.
Prioritizing safety, that has to be at the forefront of everything we do. Working individually with companies as they innovate, but then being able to create blanket tech-neutral policies that can be widely applicable.
That was Finch Fulton, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Transportation Policy in the U.S. Department of Transportation. I asked Finch what he thought about how we use roads in the crisis and what the government is doing to respond to these changes.
So some of the data that we've seen shows that travel declined for obviously the fourth consecutive week, and personal travel is down 48% since late February. So people are obviously staying home more, only critically essential trips. And we're seeing that change demand and change what we're looking at. Obviously, telecommuting is up dramatically, and the internet and the backbone there has been responding well. They operate off of what I learned is the Mother's Day rule, and that's an old telephone rule to where, you know, systems had to be ready for all the phone calls that are being made on Mother's Day. So they had to make sure the system could hold that. But what that means is there's excess capacity a lot of times, as people don't usually do that. So the internet sees that as it was established for, you know, Friday or Saturday nights with all the streaming applications that could be up.
Does that mean, since they call it the Mother's Day mode, does that mean that there's more phone calls on Mother's Day than there is on Father's Day?
Afraid so. Yay! That's what I understand from the telecom community.
So this could be like one of the longest Mother's Days in history, I guess. Well, mothers can look forward to more calls as well then, because they're up and ready for it, I suppose.
But I think also something that's interesting in terms of our supply chain, and this is actually information we got from real estate and credit card holders, it looks like we're seeing increased demand for warehouses and the types of warehouses that have freezer and cooler space that can be used for groceries. E-commerce now accounts for 3% of total U.S. grocery sales, which is obviously increasing incredibly now. And so you're seeing people are preparing and thinking through not as much of a just-in-time delivery system, but more of a something that can take these sort of shocks in the future. Walmart reported that they had nearly $900 million in online grocery sales last month, which is up 21% from February and double that of March. We're seeing, I mean, everyone feels the differences that what we're seeing of people using Amazon more, using some of these delivery services more, getting goods delivered to their doors. But what that means for sort of warehouses and additional spaces that we need, and what that means for the types of delivery vehicles and operations, it's still to be determined. But obviously, there seems we will all be waiting, sort of expecting to see as people get used to these new norms, there could very well be some just systematic changes that we see to our supply chain system and to last mile delivery.
This new normal will permanently alter the infrastructure of our cities, so Finch and his department have a huge task ahead of them. For many cities, especially in the U.S., private vehicles and public transport are the only means we have to access daily essentials like food, medicine, and fuel. We rely on transportation to bring supplies to us, to get us to where we need to be, and to reach family members. For people who can't telecommunicate, Transportation is usually the only way they can continue working. We need vehicles to keep our work systems running and to keep people safe. The Department of Transportation has already invested billions of dollars in safety technologies for automated vehicles, but Finch's team has to quickly pivot to address the current crisis.
Well, certainly our focus has shifted almost entirely to the pandemic and the response to it. I think one thing that is absolutely clear is the criticality of our supply chain, making sure that we get medical equipment, food, essential supplies where they need to be. And actually today, April 16th, Secretary Childs at the White House with President Trump and Vice President Pence honoring who are finally being recognized as America's newest heroes, which is just our country's truckers. They make up the backbone of our nation's supply chain and economy. And I think now is the time when you can't emphasize enough the work that they do to keep America running. But widespread nationwide, as we're looking at impacts to the transportation system, you know, airport traffic down 96%, reaching new lows. Domestic load factors for the planes that are in the air at 11%. The IATA is forecasting a 48% decline in global traffic for 2020 and 36% decline in North America for the entire year. If we're looking at our transit systems, there's 900 urbanized areas and transit service providers. Over 100 have suspended service entirely, and over a third have reduced dramatically their service. If you're looking at things like Amtrak, their system-wide trips are down 95%. Compared to last year, and that's 98% on the Northeast regional routes. So we went from about 1.8 million trips to less than 100,000. Freight rail is down over 15%. So we're seeing dramatic drops in transportation, you know, outside thinking about trucking. But that's why we've seen Congress coming in with the transportation-related recovery efforts in the $2.2 billion CARES Act. So these are, you know, $10 billion for airports. You've got the Treasury providing loans to the airlines, $25 billion for transit systems, $1 billion for Amtrak. I mean, this is significant investment just to keep these systems up and running and to make sure that they're cleaned and ready to go because, you know, transportation is critical in these times. And while, you know, the department's a good example, we're 95% on telework right now, but there's certain things that you have to have people in place for. Air traffic controllers can't do their work from home. So we're trying to make sure that the system's up and running, that people can get the goods they need, that the, you know, people can get from point A to point B, still get to medical appointments, still be able to get to the grocery store and have items on the shelf. The secretary and leadership's focus has been solely on that and will be for some time until we can get our feet back under us.
Finch said it. We might no longer be so mobile, but transportation is critical to the smooth running of our society. I asked him what companies are doing in response to the pandemic. He pinpointed the success of startup Nuro, which automates deliveries with a fleet of low-speed vehicles.
Have you seen anything innovative or exciting or something that surprised you in terms of a solution someone came up to, let's say, keep the transportation lines open and flowing as best we can?
There's a couple of interesting things going on. You may remember, it seems like forever ago, in February, we provided the first ever exemption for Nuro to build and operate up to 5,000 driverless delivery vehicles. And then recently, California approved them to be tested and operated on their roads. So these are package delivery vehicles that can provide groceries or medical goods from point A to point B that are legal and allowed to do this now. So this is something that we will use to be able to actually put forward the rules that allow these operations routinely. But we're seeing these vehicles, they're already on the road in Houston, and now we're seeing them in California. The FAA has seen requests for package deliveries more than double. So they both have the operations that you've seen that have already been approved with entities like UPS or Wing that used to be part of Google. But you're also seeing entities around the country put forth applications, and we're eagerly looking for them for ways that these vehicles can support first responders, they can support public security initiatives, or can provide package delivery. So they still have to be able to safely operate, but we're seeing, you know, dramatically increased interest, and we welcome that. That's something that we're trying to, you know, encourage more of. But then even things like the low-speed automated shuttles that you typically think up for transit, those are being used to run testing samples from clinics to off-site facilities and back and forth. And what's interesting is you're seeing these be used without safety drivers. So they are on something that's more akin to a closed course, but they're being able to be used to really help with the response.
From startups like Nuro to major corporations like Google, many companies are responding with novel ideas that pave the way for smart cities of the future. But it's not all plain sailing. With transport, everything is connected, so it follows that lots of people will be affected by any changes we make. Innovators need to create and also communicate. They must speak to their local law enforcement. They must get in touch with first responders. It's the best chance we have to make sure no one is left behind. Finch encourages automated tech companies to make themselves known to the Department of Transportation so they can highlight where federal and local permission is necessary and where groups can work together.
So we're seeing all sorts of innovative approaches utilizing assets that are already in place to help improve the response that we're all working together on and that we're all dealing with.
You know, we had on the Future Car podcast a company called Navya, and they actually took some of their autonomous shuttles and are now being used by the Mayo Clinic in Florida to do something very similar to what you just said, moving test samples from a drive-through testing sites back to the laboratories on the Mayo campus there. Does the DOT in some ways now get more directly involved in some of these things to make it easier to deploy these types of technologies? Or is it, you know, sort of observing more a little bit standing back? Do you get directly involved in any way?
When they come to us for things like exemptions from the current rules, the current safety rules and standards are absolutely still in place. So if they want to do something that challenges these rules, like what we've seen with Nuro, they do have to come to us and we do work directly with them. But we're trying to make sure there's clarity on, you know, what safety components absolutely must be followed, what is allowed to be done, what do you have to get permission to do, and what is still something that we have to work on in the future. So really it's providing clarity, but we're having a number of one-on-one engagements. We're having a lot of individual approvals that we have to conduct. Certainly it's different if you're talking about drones and the FAA's authorities versus NHTSA or FTAs and some of these transit or vehicle authorities. I would say we're very actively engaged, but of course we're respecting the federal role versus state and local roles in these technologies.
Automated public transport will soon become widespread, but the corona pandemic has revealed more difficulties. It will be a major challenge for engineers to find solutions that keep vehicles clean. How can we reach a level of hygiene on buses and trains that will make people comfortable?
Yeah, well, that's always been a challenge. It's a challenge for Uber and Lyft. You know, they can predict the time of day and the places and cities where people are most likely to throw up in their vehicles. So even if you were just looking at things like that of partiers of recent years and the sort of disruptions they can make in shared vehicles, we've already been having to face these questions in terms of how, potentially automated shared vehicles would work. So it's something that people have been thinking about for a long time, and I think the importance of these questions and the way it will affect consumer preference is just increasing. And so I expect more research dollars to flow in that direction.
These technologies are also subject to regulation. Companies must get the go-ahead from an intricate network of authorities, from Congress and the Senate to state and local governments, before they roll out new products and services. How do all these different governmental groups work together? How do you coordinate to get to the best regulations as soon as we can?
Well, there's a few different items there. First, we work closely with our congressional entities, the congressional oversight bodies, the committees of jurisdiction that work with us on these items. So as they propose new bills, they'll come to us for technical assistance. We'll bounce them back and forth. But thinking through what they see the challenges are really shapes our research and shapes our initiatives. So you'll see a lot of what the department is doing is responsive to committees like the Senate Commerce Committee, who has been putting forth these automated vehicle proposals, trying to figure out a best path forward. But many of them are directing the department to enact regulations or to conduct research. We hear that. We see that. We're on board. We're not waiting for Congress to pass legislation for us to do the research and to move forward the regulatory processes going forward. So we very much are in lockstep. But what I think people lose is the idea that we have to have these regulations in place that really specify the types of technologies that are used.
Sure, there are benefits to being able to pass through new technology quickly, but with so many end users, we leave ourselves open to error. Think about the time we need to find and roll out new vaccines. Whether it's medical or the automotive industry, we have to demonstrate safety and effectivity. Both take time, which many feel we don't have, but rushing regulatory measures can lead to problems later on in the process.
With airbags, we saw a rush to regulate and specific requirements for what an airbag should be like. Of course, they were targeting, you know, your average middle-aged male that had certain body characteristics and types.
Hello!
And they were mandating airbags that were causing significant damage to elderly populations, to children, to women. Because of the government's over-eagerness to mandate, they probably delayed the full integration of airbags by years and years. There's a very interesting report by the RAND, a RAND report on this subject. But the point of that is to say, we are eager for the safety improvements that can be made to these technologies, but we have to respect the role of the innovators and the role of the federal government and not rush to regulate these and really specify it. We need to have performance-based regulations that can be adaptable over time, and we can let these different approaches to the safety of these technologies play out while still providing oversight and working individually with these companies to ensure that these are incorporated safely into the fleets. It really requires a lot of discipline by the federal government, and it's something I think that is important.
It's interesting. So this requirement for discipline, right? And an interesting thing you just said was that, well, if things are rapidly changing, right, let's put a set of regulations in place, but these regulations have to evolve, right, as you learn more about technology. And I would imagine that it requires for the legislators to be able to understand technology. Now, if technology is somewhat steady state, that's one thing. But when it's rapidly changing weekly, monthly, I would imagine your role as technical advisor must be really challenging. Not only, one, you have to stay on top of the technology, but then you have to be able to explain it to legislators, many of which aren't engineers. Have you found challenges more recently because of the rapidly changing technology as to what it takes to educate the people that are actually going to make our laws and regulations so that they can make informed decisions on which direction to go?
Well, there's a few different efforts that we're taking that can help educate everyone, whether it be ourselves, the public, or our congressional partners. Certainly, there are many of them that are very sophisticated. We've recently put out $60 million that Congress provided us for automated driving system demonstration grants. They're prioritizing safety and how to prove the safety of these operations, providing us data for upcoming standards and rulemaking. But one of the things we also see is that if people actually get to see and understand and touch, tangibly touch these vehicles and see the types of operations that happen, their comfort level is dramatically increased. We're also working on what we're calling a communicators initiative. And this is something that back in January, Secretary endorsed specific language that the department had been able to review and vet before they announced it, that SAE, Consumer Reports, J.D. Power and Associates, some of those other similar groups came together and said, here's how we're going to talk about these technologies. There's sort of three pieces of it. How do the engineers talk to themselves about these technologies? Super technical, super wonky. But what does that mean for the legislators or the, wonks in the departments and agencies that are fairly sophisticated, but we're not engineers? And then what does that mean for the public? What does that mean if we're trying to, you know, talk to my parents? What does that mean the technology can do, because we do see there are very real safety concerns about people over-relying on these technologies, assuming that they're true, you know, level 5 automated vehicle technologies, when in reality, they're more akin to fancy cruise control or a lane-keeping assist. So ensuring that people actually understand what a vehicle can do and what it cannot do is critical to the safe deployment and integration of these technologies going forward.
Technologies for automated vehicles affects everyone. So the more input we get, the greater the chance we'll come up with solutions that are beneficial to all. What kinds of people are using public transport, and what do they need? How can we manage peak times in overpopulated cities? How can we prepare automated vehicles for an aging population? If we don't have the right people on board, we'll only ever get half the picture. That can lead to disaster. One critical sector, security, was forgotten during talks for drone development.
One of the reasons why we thought it was so important to bring in our security partners is the lessons we learned about when that didn't happen years ago with drones. So we've lost years of rulemaking progress because In previous years, the transportation sector didn't include the security sector. And so as drones were getting ready to take off, suddenly our national security partners expressed great concern that this widespread change was happening, and they hadn't been included. They didn't know how to handle that. They weren't preparing their systems. And so we lost years of progress on the federal government side as we were bringing our security partners back on board and incorporating them and introducing them to some of the innovators in the drone space. So one of the things we wanted to make sure we were doing is including our security partners today in the work that we're going to be doing tomorrow for automated vehicles. It's a real lesson learned and something that we are hoping to do better in the future.
This was the message to everyone involved in creating automated vehicles. Communicate, share data, distribute guidance as widely as you can. Think deeply about who can be impacted by technological development and go speak to them. Bring together city architects with vehicle engineers. Speak to marginalized voices, those who need help with mobility, and ask them what they need. Never work on infrastructural challenges in isolation. Working with a diverse cast of voices will help us better prepare for a future crisis.
It is about bringing people with different types of expertise together, because an engineer may be an expert at what they're doing, but unless they talk to somebody that's blind, you know, it's actually amazing to be on meetings and they'll pass out paper copies of something, and it's like, you just handed it to somebody that's blind. Like, you need to have, did you provide a digital copy before the meeting? They can read it on their computer, you know, and it's a lot of these commonsensical things that when you're in the room with somebody, you're like, oh my goodness, that makes sense. Why didn't I think about that? So making sure that we bring together these different types of people and say in the room with each other, but together in collaborative environments, it really opens up a lot of doors as you see things that are common sense to somebody but may not be to someone else.
It brings to mind, I gave a talk last year to a group in Europe. It was a group of suppliers that supplied systems to help disabled people drive. And there's really two groups in there. One was to create controls that would allow you to modify a production vehicle, right? So that you could drive with just your hands or whatever it might be. And then there was another group that would convert vans with ramps and things like that. And they asked me to speak to them about autonomous vehicles. And as I listened to them, as the day went on, at the end of the day, they asked me to give them some impressions of what I learned. And I said, well, you know, you're really at a crossroads here. Because if driving goes away, right, or significantly is reduced, the need to modify vehicles so you can drive is also going to be significantly reduced. And then you have an opportunity now to redesign these vehicles. There's not going to be a driver in there. So you could almost look at it like if you take like a shuttle or something, an open platform where maybe that vehicle is not that different than a vehicle that someone that's not disabled would want. They're still going to want TVs. They're still going to want all the screens or access and all that. They're going to want to be, they'll love to be able to get in and out. And in some ways, taking the driver out, the needs of people closer together, regardless if, you know, if you're disabled or if you're not. And in a way, I said, you know, you have to may possibly start looking at your business in a different way. Rather than converting vans with ramps, your job now is to make sure you create an environment that anyone would enjoy, but that also someone that's disabled could easily get in and out of with their wheelchair. Because with electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles now, the floor level is a lot lower. It's easier to roll in and out. You don't have to worry about putting them in a driver's seat. You know, maybe a wheelchair could go in and automatically lock in position, things like this. And there's, again, an example, right, where, you know, coming in from a view of autonomous vehicles and interacting with some people that were really in the job of making current vehicles accessible so that anyone could drive it, you know, brought together two different viewpoints. And I think that's a key piece, right? If you want innovation, bringing together people like we were talking about earlier, maybe from the construction industry or whatever it might be, together with people that engineer cars could be pretty key to getting some new ideas floated out there.
Absolutely. And I mean, it is an opportunity for the aftermarket manufacturers that, you know, put on these wheelchair capable vehicles, bring them in the room with the OEMs. Maybe they can be part of the supply chain to creating these more accessible vehicles. And you do flag something that's key and important. People in wheelchairs, they have unique needs for what the vehicles can do for them. And they represent a group that has a much higher level of cost that goes into these vehicles. And it is, they're specifically called out in many of our programs because of these unique needs. But the majority of Americans will be disabled at some point in their lives. Thinking through the process of aging or thinking through, you know, temporary illnesses or injuries. But that's why it's critical to think about the unique needs of somebody that's deaf, the unique needs of somebody that's blind, unique needs of somebody that's limited mobility-wise, that can't kick up their leg and hop in a vehicle or have all of their limbs working. The unique needs of people with cognitive disabilities, and what does that mean in terms of being able to ride in a vehicle that drives itself or in a public transportation type vehicle with others. And then again, the limitations that can come with aging, things like that. It's all part of a package of things that need to be thought through. That's why I'm bringing everybody together so that they can focus on the future needs of a car. We may not get there to a fully universally designed vehicle today, but if we take X step, maybe it can have Y percentage improvements to accessibility, which maybe leads to, a certain percentage of new sales for OEMs. Trying to outline that path for them all is something that I think, there is a subtle role in accessibility for these vehicles, and it's something that we've been focusing on with our research dollars and with our policy initiatives.
Yeah, there's probably different levels of being transportation challenged, right? And as you get older, that challenge is going to get greater and greater and greater. Again, it could be as making it easy for someone with a cane to get in and out, or someone in a wheelchair, or someone that's blind or partially can see. And I think that's got to be an area for you, not only regulation, but bringing together the right people to start to address those challenges, because there's certainly going to be an opportunity here to try and solve the problem in a completely new way when you can, like I said, redesign not only the vehicle, but maybe the infrastructure that goes with it to reduce the transportation challenges. Thanks for joining us today. For more about our products and services, visit Siemens PLM software online at plm.automation.siemens.com. And stay tuned for our next episode with Dr. Ashley O'Donoghue from Beth Israel Harvard. In the meantime, stay safe, stay informed, and let's use our roads responsibly.